This Is Money's podcast is brought to you in partnership with the Financial Services Compensation Scheme. Check your financial products at FSCS Protected at fscs.org.uk/thisismoney.
Welcome to This Is Money. I'm Georgie Frost, and alongside me and editor Simon Lambert today is assistant editor Lee Boyce. And after more than 1,300 days, Britain is leaving the EU. But what will it mean for our personal finances, for our rights, for expats and for travellers? Also today, Simon takes a deep dive into property prices, but not over the last 3 years. Over the last 174 years, are you all sitting comfortably? An interesting look, or can we actually learn something from the past? We also have a Woodford update as investors find out how much cash they can expect back and which bank is in our bad books today. And don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, whether you like it or not, it's happening. More than 1,300 days after the referendum, Britain is saying adieu, ciao, auf Wiedersehen pet to the EU. We now enter a transition period until December the 31st, while all the final details are ironed out. I say that somewhat optimistically, but closer to our own homes and our lives. What will Brexit mean in terms of our personal finances, mobile phones, holidays, pension, consumer rights, etc., etc.? So let's zoom out, though, first. Simon, what will it mean in terms of the general economy? I'm not asking you to crystal ball gaze. I'm asking you to say what other people are crystal ball gazing and saying. What are the experts thinking will happen?
Well, firstly, I should say that there is a strong possibility that many of the people who listen to this podcast, who may not listen to it the moment that it goes out on Friday evening, they may be listening over the weekend or the week following, could actually now be listening to it in a Britain that has left the EU. We are recording this before 11 p.m. on Friday. It is the final insult, I believe, in the Brexit process that we cannot even leave on our own time, that we have to leave on continental time. I think that we should have refused to leave until midnight. Yep. However, it seems that we don't get to set that. We could have come to a compromise. I mean,
that is the ultimate indicator
of how the negotiations went, is that we didn't compromise on 11:30. But 11 o'clock? No, things change at midnight. One day you're in, the next day you're out.
It's like a tax year.
Not one day you're in for 23 hours and then you spend an hour out as a sort of little preparation for the next day.
Yeah.
No. I would have liked to have left at midnight, personally.
Right.
You know. Not to come across all Nigel Farage here. We could have just sort of come to some form of agreement where, according to the EU, we'd gone at 11 o'clock, but according to us, we went at midnight.
Splitting hairs here, I think, Simon. Mm. I think, does it really half an hour? Well, never mind. It gives them plenty of time to pop open the champagne corks and, you know, get the fireworks
out. It does, doesn't it?
Have your parties.
That's the thing, isn't it? It's probably more convenient for people because they don't have to stay up quite as late as they do on New Year's Eve. They can pop the champagne. Sorry, they can pop the English sparkling corks at 11 o'clock.
Anyway, we digress. Yes. We digress.
Yeah, we digress. Look, to be, in all honesty, if you are listening to this before 11 o'clock or after 11 o'clock on Friday, you won't really notice much difference until at least December the 31st. Because until December the 31st this year, we are in our transition period. That thing that we spent all that time arguing about, and throughout which things are essentially going to be pretty much the same, but slightly different. Now, going on to your question of where does this leave us in terms of the economy, etc., I think that all depends on how much of the next 11 months we spend arguing about stuff, more important stuff than whether we should be leaving at 11 p.m. or midnight. And we've had the so-called Boris bounce. Mm-hmm. We've had the certainty after the election. I think that despite it, this being talked up quite heavily in some quarters to a level above what I think is reasonable, there is a little bit more swing in Britain's step. I think people have got fed up with the political impasse. And I think even some of those who definitely don't think that Boris Johnson should be Prime Minister do still appreciate this extra bit of certainty. A majority government, one that might actually be able to do things. But there's a lot of concern about what they might do. And there's a lot of concern about how these trade negotiations are going to go. And after we have left the EU after Brexit Day, after January the 31st, presumably not on Saturday or on Sunday, but come Monday, that's when we're going to start getting all the news and all the trade negotiation stuff. It's not going to start straight away, but it's going to start filtering through. And this little honeymoon period we've had, where we had the election and then everybody breathed a deep sigh of relief that the election was over and they could get on with Christmas, and then they came back in January and we didn't really do much talking about Brexit, did we? Well, it's going to start again. And these trade negotiations are not going to be easy. And I would imagine that along the way, there's going to be concerns about No Deal 2. No Deal 2 being that come the end of this year, we go out of the EU without a proper trade deal. And that's going to have an impact on businesses, decisions to invest, decisions on where to locate. If you are a big global business, do you add an extra 500 staff in London? Do you add an extra 500 staff in Frankfurt, particularly for the finance sector? It's going to have an impact for the pound. Expect to see the pound swinging around. And it's going to have an impact on consumers, who are going to see more uncertainty when they thought uncertainty was a thing of the past, and they might just put off those big decisions again. And that's why I'm not entirely convinced by a lot of the Boris bounce talk in the property market, for example. I don't see much that has actually substantially changed here. And I don't want to sound like a pessimist here. I am an optimist. I'm a cautious optimist by nature, but I also don't think that we should be delusional.
Right.
I'm not sure that's really... I mean, yeah, I suppose it could make you happy, but... delusional is probably not the way forward.
Lee?
It feels like so long ago now, doesn't it, Georgie, when the three of us were recording that podcast on the morning of the result. We were all kind of shocked.
We were live on air.
I remember being on the train at I don't know what time, thinking, wow, I'm watching FTSE 100 graphs and pound graphs on my way and thinking, wow, how are we going to record this podcast? It's like almost impossible, because we weren't kind of expecting it. It was a bit of a long shot, wasn't it? And I think, you know, the establishment weren't really expecting it. David Cameron resigned. It was just utter chaos. And what's ensued since then has been just more of the same. And we have spoken about it and spoken about it and spoken about it. Actually, I think a lot of people have just had Brexit fatigue. The last year, I just honestly, when Theresa May and couldn't get the deal through, couldn't get it through Parliament, it was kind of, where is this all heading? It all just felt like it was just going to hit a dead end. And I just honestly didn't know what was going to happen. Yeah. And of course, the questions from a personal finance aspect have hit us thick and fast. And the truth is, they're quite hard to answer. Mm-hmm. A lot of it's been hard to answer because a lot of it's been up in the air. But we do have some answers to some of the personal finance aspects to it.
We'll hit us with them later.
Which we will talk about. So some of the big things, I guess, and some of the things in which the EU has been good for people. Look, I'm not going to start spouting out my political views. You know, this is very much a neutral.
Oh yeah, we're done with that anyway.
Yeah, exactly. We're done with that.
We're on to the practicals.
You know, for example, the European Health Insurance Card. That's actually been something that's been incredibly useful. It's been around since 2006.
The E111.
Yeah,
card,
you could call it the E111 if you want. If you want to be down with the kids.
I'm still calling it EHIC, Lee. I've not moved on.
EHIC. Yeah, I call it EHIC. It's actually saved people £1 billion since it launched in 2006. So that's people that have been in the EU that have needed medical care for whatever reason. I had a friend in Holland who had to go to hospital after having a fall, and the bill would have been something like €800 or something. Mm. But of course, as we always say, you should have it. Doesn't replace travel insurance anyway.
Absolutely.
So you should have it. So anyway, they're saying that that's going to be valid until the end of the year. We don't know. It's unclear from the negotiations that are still to come whether that's going to be viable from 2021 onwards, but you still need travel insurance anyway, and nothing changes there. You should have travel insurance regardless. The danger with the EHIC is people go, oh, I don't need travel insurance because you know, if something goes wrong, you know, I'll be covered at hospital. But other things happen, you know, it's not just your health. Driving abroad, requirements are going to stay the same. So if you're taking your own vehicle, you need to take your license, logbook, insurance certificate. From next year, you might need to get an international driving permit. again. That's something that kind of reared its ugly head a little while back, and the post office kind of got a bit swamped with people buying international driving permits. Then it sort of transpired that you didn't particularly need an international driving permit yet, but we had a taster of the chaos that could ensue at the post office. Another big one is mobile data and calls and texts abroad. Now, it was a massive money-making scheme, mobile operators, when you were away in anywhere in the world, but Europe is so close to home, you know, and a lot of the mobile providers are the same providers that are here, and people were just getting ripped off. You know, if you left your mobile data on, you could end up getting charged quite a bit.
A lot of money. So the EU stepped in, did something useful. That was only quite recently, wasn't it?
Fairly recent. And again, it's one of those things where you go, well, we've lived without it before, and it's been nice to have it, but it could, from the end of this year, be a thing of the past. One mobile operator, no, three, has guaranteed that they won't change it. So if you're a three customer, you shouldn't see any change from next year. It's quite handy if you're abroad, Google Maps, going to TripAdvisor, looking for the best restaurant. But hey, we can let's go back. You can go back to maps, like, you know, an actual map, or
try out your French
nose.
Or something.
Exactly.
Bonjour.
Maybe it'd be a blessing.
Yeah,
but you know, business people making phone calls and that kind of thing is a bit of a different.
Knocking three is whenever any of these companies say, "Oh, we will keep it in place," you always think, okay, but for how long? What I mean? If that sort of protection is taken away, then for how long?
And again, it might be negotiated in which, you know, you could just step in and say, well, my brother says, no, you can't do that.
Yeah.
No, you can't do it. This has been good, and this is how it's going to work, and we're going to enshrine this into UK law. You know, there's nothing that could stop that. However, there are so many things to negotiate and think about. Yeah. You just wonder what the pecking order is of importance of all this kind of stuff and all these kind of things that could happen. The other one that's worth pointing out as well is flight compensation. So you get €600, which is about £510 up to if your flight arrives 3 hours late. And the government has pledged to keep this in place. So that shouldn't change. There are other things you're talking about, sort of consumer rights. So the Consumer Rights Act 2015 is UK law anyway, so that won't change. So there are lots of different elements to this, and we're going to talk about expats and pensioners in a short while as well, who have been, I would say, amongst the most fearful group. You know, we're talking about people living out in Spain, France, who have retired out there, worried about their pensions and healthcare. Well, as I said, we'll mention that in a minute. But, you know, this is the tip of the iceberg right here. What we're talking about is the tip of the personal finance iceberg. We're not talking about what overarching effects any dip in the economy or boom in the economy might have to things like your pension, to your investments, to your savings rates. There is a lot that is going to unfold, and it will be interesting when we come up to the 31st of December, then we go into the next day, because for me, that's when I feel like a lot is going to change. We've got all of this transition period in which we've kind of negotiated that it will go up until the end of the year, and then it's kind of like, then what?
That's when the real stuff starts happening, right?
Well, I think so.
Okay.
The meaty stuff, the juicy stuff.
I will probably get with any, she says so optimistically, some sort of dribs and drabs, I imagine, before then, of what we're likely to get, promises.
We've got a budget coming in March. That's going to be interesting.
Precisely. What they're going to say, who knows? We'll discuss that a bit closer to the time, I imagine. But Lee, what you've spoken about, you're absolutely right. You've been speaking about, you know, going abroad and going on your holidays, working abroad, and we'll get onto the expats in a minute. But as you've said, tip of the iceberg, what happened, Simon, with, you know, you spoke about the economy and the likely impact, and let's be honest, nobody knows. But what would that mean for, just loosely, for things like savings, for pensions, for interest rates, for all these sorts of things that will affect, the pound in our pocket?
We don't know, really. Mm.
All right, then.
That depends on all kinds of external circumstances. Just leaving the EU isn't necessarily going to, you know, cause massive volatility. It's what happens next and how the future trade arrangement looks, whether those trade talks break down. Do we end up with no deal two at the end of 2020? How much off GDP will it knock off? Is there really any merit to the argument that this buccaneering, free trading Britain will capitalise on our relationship with the rest of the world? It's almost impossible to tell. It's pure conjecture. The pound at the moment is working on the basis that we will have some kind of orderly exit. I would imagine if we strike a good trade deal, the pound will rise. If it looks like we're not going to get a trade deal, the pound will obviously fall. In turn, that makes prices go up because we import a lot of stuff. That will lead to higher inflation. Would that lead through to the Bank of England raising interest rates? Potentially it would, but then the Bank of England has tended to look through temporary inflation shocks. If it were to raise interest rates, that would limit the demand for money. It would limit activity in the economy. That would be seen as being sort of bad for business, bad for consumers, make mortgages more expensive. Savers would throw their hats in the air and cheer. But on the other hand, it could be that we end up getting a recession and then they feel forced to cut interest rates. Now, that would have the impact of making the pound fall. It would boost things for our exporters because their products would become cheaper. Would that be enough to overcome any barriers to trade? Savers wouldn't be happy. It might make mortgages even cheaper. But in all honesty, I can't really see how mortgages can get much cheaper than they are from here. So there's all kinds of things going on there. But then you've then got to think about other things. What's going to happen with the US and China trade deal? That's one of the key things that's worrying markets at the moment. The US election is coming up later this year. That is going to be a big thing. What's going to happen? Is Trump going to get in again? Are you going to get a much more heavily left-wing Democrat get in? That could substantially change the direction of travel for the US economy, which is the biggest in the world and which is driving a lot of the stock market growth that's gone on. I think for individual people, it comes down to just using it as a reminder to make sure that you can get your finances as watertight as possible.
Same old advice, isn't it, really?
Literally the same old advice. Just do the things that you should be doing and try not to worry too much about the big bad world.
Yeah, but don't be delusional, though.
But don't be delusional. Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. Lee, you did mention the situation for British expats in the EU. The government did confirm that they're going to continue to get annual increases in the state pension, and their healthcare rights are also going to be protected. But there's an issue for those people who are moving after this year. Of course, we've just said we don't know what's going to be happening this year, but after this year, you may see your pension payments frozen unless we can strike a Brexit deal. Not that I doubt that's going to absolutely happen incredibly swiftly, Lee, and it's all going to be sorted out by the 31st. But just if you would tell us more, the guarantees for the for existing expats.
Yeah, so there's quite a few elements actually to this, Georgie, which I will explain. But in a nutshell, firstly, there are 650,000 retired expats living in the EU. That's quite a large slice of people, and they have been worried about whether or not their state pensions are going to increase with the triple lock. Now, the triple lock is your state pension is guaranteed to rise each April by either price inflation, average earnings growth, or 2.5%, whatever's the highest out of those figures. It can have quite an uplift. And if you've been retired in a country in which pensions have been frozen for a number of years, the ravages of inflation, etc., means that your pension is just frozen at whatever level it was when you moved there. Now, most of the world in which UK expats outside of the EU live, the rest of the world, pretty much all of it has frozen pensions. America is one of the examples where it's not, but places like Canada and New Zealand, there's 500,000 expats that have frozen state pensions, and there's been a massive campaign which is separate in which they want these pensions to be unfrozen. They want it to rise with triple lock as well, but obviously it's expensive for the government. Mm-hmm. But their argument is that they've paid into the system all their lives and they've chosen to go and live somewhere else. They're not a burden on the healthcare system, they're not a burden on this country, and that they should have those rises. Now, it's been guaranteed for these EU expats. However, from the 31st of December, again, it's a key theme here, isn't it? So yeah. Basically, from the start of 2021, if you are moving out there and retiring, it's not guaranteed that you're not going to have a frozen state pension. It hasn't been negotiated yet. We don't know what's going to happen beyond that. There might be a high chance that that won't happen. And there's also some question marks around, for example, we've had some questions in which, let's say you are not of pensionable age, but you are an expat, you've moved to somewhere for work, you've got a younger family, say you're in your 30s, 40s, 50s, does this guarantee stretch if you end up staying there when you get your state pension? You know, okay, your state pension, if you've gone out in your 30s, probably isn't going to be particularly high. But if you're someone that's on the cusp of retirement or 5 years off or 10 years off and you're an expat out there, it's kind of unknown whether or not your state pension is going to rise by triple up, which is really important because this April it's going to go up by 3.9%, which is a quite big uplift. It's based on earnings growth from July, and it's the highest uplift since 2012-2013 when it went up 5.2% because inflation was riding high. So it can have, over a period of time, a big impact. And we're thinking about pensioners as well. You know, they worry about the healthcare situation, and there was a lot of concern over how that was going to play out. I stayed late in the office last Friday when this news came out, because the ambassador for Spain was the person that kind of revealed this in a Facebook video, no less, on a popular expat page, saying about these pension changes, but also saying that the healthcare was going to be guaranteed for these expat pensioners. So it's clear that it's important to these people. There are some spots around the EU which are incredibly popular to retire to. Costa del Sol. I mean, it could have been the end of Costa del Britain. If that was the case, it might have been a mass exodus. Who knows? But, you know, these sorts of things, I think when you are a little bit removed from it, I don't know anyone that's retired out there, so I'm quite far removed from that part. I just don't really think about it too much.
I know a lot of friends who work out there, but no one who's retired.
Yeah, and it's quite, but then you see the figure, you know, 650,000 people. That, you know, a lot of people that were worried about how it's going to play out.
Absolutely.
And from next year, it might be more difficult to go and retire into the EU. So we've had some government advice out actually this week on Thursday, saying that if you're a tourist, you can go into the EU 90 days out of 180 days. So you won't need a visa for that. You should be able to still freely travel. It's unlikely, unless you are working or doing something else, that you'll need a visa. Now, doing something else could be retiring out into these countries. And again, it's not clear. You know, some countries around the world have capital requirements, for example. So if you wanted to go and retire out in Australia, you know, you might need to hold a certain amount of money in savings to prove that you can pay for your healthcare or for other things.
And I assume that would be specific, I don't know if you know this, specific to the country as opposed to an EU kind of...
I don't know the answer to that. I mean, you'd think it wouldn't be. I would have thought it would be a blanket EU thing, just because if you take Spain and France, which probably take the biggest slice, I don't know what percentages they take of, you know, expats that retire out there. I mean, it's massive. People go out there to retire for you know, the weather, the style of life. It's not clear what that would be. Let's face it as well. Let's flip it on its head and think about Spain. You know, a lot of Spain is built around tourism, and a lot of Spain is built around the expats out there uplift some of the economy. You know, they're not just there doing nothing. You know, they're spending their money, they have family that go and visit out there. You know, I don't think that all of a sudden Spain's going to turn around and go, right, sell up, get out, you're not welcome here anymore. You know, I think there's been a bit of that kind of nasty chat around Brexit, regardless, about everything.
Yeah, you know, you can understand concerns,
but I think, let's face it, when there's money involved, it doesn't matter what country you are, you want to attract people that are going to spend money.
And especially Spain, I'd suggest, at the moment.
I would suggest so. You know, and there's a lot of economics behind that, and that's maybe just a bit of a flippant, widespread comment. I'm not narrowing down, drilling down on any details or data on that.
Yeah.
But it is still in the interest to have people there.
Absolutely, it is. All right, we're going to put that to one side because, Simon, you did speak about house prices. And, of course, you know, we love talking about property in this country, except me. But Brexit has only served, I reckon, to ramp that chat up. But, Simon, you've been looking at the picture of house prices over a little bit longer than that, 174 years, in fact. Why?
Well, we often talk about house prices, we get lots of reports, don't we?
We get lots
of focus put on extremely volatile monthly numbers. For example, Nationwide's house price index showed a 0.5% rise in January this week. January had not finished, which equated to £615 on the annual home.
Right.
Evidence of the Boris bounce
we saw
from some quarters. I'm not sure whether you can really read that much into volatile monthly house prices. Annual house prices matter. They're up 1.9% over the past year.
Mm-hmm.
That's less than wages, but now more than inflation. That's interesting. Sometimes we look back 10 years. We just had the end of a decade. Of course, we did that. Sometimes we look back a little bit further. But when do we ever really, really look back across entire eras? Well, a very interesting piece of research that was done by investment firm Schroders. A chap called Duncan Lamont there looked at 174 years of housing affordability.
And that's, is there a reason for that, or is that just all the all the years that we've got, I assume?
Yeah, it goes back to the start of the Victorian era.
Right.
So you've got the Victorian era, the Edwardian era, the First World War, then the period between the wars. You've got the post-war boom, go running through to Thatcher's 80s, the 1990s, the Blair and Brown years, the financial crisis, austerity, and then Brexit Britain. Quick potted tour of history there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Move on.
And what did you find?
Well, what's interesting about this is a look not at 174 years of house prices, but at 174 years of housing affordability. And that's really the thing that matters, isn't it? Because we don't actually care what the physical number put on a house is. What really matters is, can we afford it?
Yeah.
So, houses have only ever been as expensive as they are now compared to wages twice in the past 120 years. It will come as no surprise to anyone with more than a passing interest in the property market that one of those times was just before the financial crisis, the peak of the 2000s boom. What may be more surprising is that the other time was 1900. So why were houses at eight times wages in 1900 as well? But what's even more surprising is the fact that before that, they were substantially more expensive. And in fact, from through the Victorian and Edwardian era, from about 1845 or so, 1840, to about 1911, they actually got cheaper over the course of 70 years.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine 70 years of houses getting cheaper.
Our
entire theory of housing and that whole question of pension versus property that you read in the celebrity interviews, every time you hear people, you're like, oh, well, put it in property, safe as houses, property always goes up, is built on the idea that property will get more expensive, that it will beat inflation, that it will beat wages, that it will beat other investments. Turn that on its head. 70 years of them getting cheaper. So what on earth happened there? Well, three main things. One, we built a lot more houses throughout the Victorian era. Two, those houses got substantially smaller. And the final piece of the jigsaw is wages went up. So, more houses. The housing stock in England and Wales between 1851 and 1911 rose from 3.4 million houses to 7.7 million houses. That is effectively more than doubling.
Goodness.
That's a lot. Smaller houses. Houses built before 1850 were significantly larger than those built after. Prior to 1850, the average house had a plot size. This isn't the size of the house, but it's the plot. 913 square metres. In the next 50 years, the average plot size was 268. So that's a lot smaller. And this reflected a shift towards smaller housing, so from detached houses towards terraces, but also a downshift in the average size of houses in the categories. So, for example, terraces. We built more terraces, but the terraces got substantially smaller. Wages went up 90% between 1845 and 1911. Average house prices fell by 23%. So that's a slow grind down of 0.4% a year, while wages went up by an average of 1.1% a year. So all of that led to 70 years of falling house prices, which is historically quite interesting. But then, how does that relate to today? Well, in order to take the same level of affordability on the houses, to go from at the point in 1845 when they were 13 times wages to being eight times wages in 1911, is a similar reduction as from the eight times that they are now to going to 4.5 times, the long run average up until the 2000s boom. But we can't double the housing stock in the country. And that is just a completely unrealistic proposition. Even all of the people who advocate building more homes, doubling the housing stock, almost impossible. Can we make them much smaller? Well, we could do. And Duncan, in his report, says we can't rule out hobbit homes. But
I'm sure I've seen an article on your website about the micro homes that are taking off elsewhere
but
in the world.
But the thing is new build houses in the UK aren't exactly praised at the moment
no.
for their generous size or their substantial gardens, are they? So I'm not sure people are going to want to go for it. Also, even the idea of bringing house prices down over the course of 70 years might be somewhat politically unpopular in a nation where people are expecting them to rise and to be a good lifetime investment. But there's another piece of the picture that you can't ignore and that Duncan talks about here, which is he refers to a recent Bank of England working paper that came out before Christmas about cheap money, low interest rates. This Bank of England working paper concluded that almost all of the gains in house prices above inflation and wages since the mid-80s had been driven by falling real interest rates. Money got cheaper, so houses got more expensive, to paraphrase much smarter people than me. And that actually building more homes, unless you can do what the Victorians did and double the amount of houses, is not feasibly going to reduce prices. There's another very interesting thing, though, if you think about the Victorian era, that isn't in this report but was in a recent Economist report on housing and the problem of expensive housing, which is that also through the Victorian and then through the First and Second World Wars, probably right up until about the 1950s, there was something else that happened. Transport improved dramatically. So you had think about the UK, you had the building of the railways. It enabled people to live further away than where they need, than the place they needed to get to in order to earn some money. You had the growth of the suburbs. You had the road building program. You had personal ownership of cars. Once you get to a point, sort of post-war 1950, that kind of died out. I probably doubt that most people can get to their place of work considerably quicker now than they could 50 years ago. Cars have got much faster, but we have a lot more of them on the road. And if you look at statistics, average traffic speeds are down. The railways, we've got trains that are faster, but are we getting people into work quicker? Are people able to live further away from work? So
broadband? And broadband,
exactly.
Working from home?
All very good and well and good, but not enough of the population spending enough of their time working from home for that to make a meaningful difference. You'd need to make it that perhaps half the workforce were working every day a week from home to make the kind of meaningful difference that we're talking about here, compared to going from the horse and cart to everybody just being able to jump on a train or jump in their car. So it's an interesting bit of history, but it's also an interesting bit of how do we try to take some of those elements in order to move forwards, and which ones are realistic. And when we just get the argument of we just must build more homes, would that actually make a difference? And how would we make it make a difference? Because if we can't build that many more new homes, what can we do with the ones that we can build, and what are the other levers we can pull? And realistically, I think it comes down to the fact that we don't want money to keep getting much cheaper. In fact, we probably want it to get a bit more expensive, which limits the ability to buy these expensive houses. And that's an issue for people who would like to buy a house. But ultimately, in the long term, it's better for society for property to get cheaper rather than more expensive.
So is that the takeout? I mean, it obviously all sounds very interesting. You know, a little bit geeky, not going to lie, sir.
Very geeky.
A little bit geeky.
Very geeky.
But what would you say, if someone was looking at this report now, what is the real sort of takeaway from it, the real useful thing that we can have going forward?
What the takeaway from it is that, A, you shouldn't always just expect that houses should get more expensive, because...
Right,
here's 70 years is quite a long time.
Yeah.
If we talk about
You're blown away by 10 years or something,
70 years is quite a long time, okay, for them to get cheaper. Secondly, you can look at the things that made that happen. Can you do the same things today? Maybe you can't, but what elements could you take from it? For example, the house building, what can you do there? The transport, what can you do there? And thirdly, it also does deliver yet another element of the argument that it's cheap money that has caused a lot of the problems of the last 30 to 40 years. But there is some interesting stuff in here. For example, the building booms that the UK saw. So there was a building boom in the Victorian era. Obviously, then house building crashed during the First World War. You then had the 1920s, very difficult period. There was then a private sector building boom in the 1930s. I mean, look around. There's lots of 1930s houses.
Mm-hmm.
That obviously tanked during the Second World War. But then after the Second World War, there was another building boom, but that was largely a public sector building boom, 50s, 60s, 70s. In the 70s, there was a change in attitude, and the decision that it would be better, instead of building houses to give to people, to give people money in order to pay for the housing that they needed, which came through to the rise of housing benefit and the decline in building council houses. And the idea was that it wasn't a problem selling off the council houses because we were helping people who needed the help to afford housing with housing benefit, and the private sector would step in and people would be able to pay the private sector, and the private sector would deliver better houses, because there were concerns about the standard of some of these public sector projects that were thrown up. But it demonstrates that in a market that doesn't work properly, you can't necessarily apply that kind of economics, because, as we've seen from the past 30 or 40 years, that whole experiment with not building the public sector houses and instead of just giving people money to pay for it didn't work, because public sector house building has been minuscule. So there's all kinds of things you can look at there. But what it does is, housing is a national debate in this country. Whether you have any interest in house prices or whatever or not, having a roof over your head is a fundamental issue for an awful lot of people. Goes all the way from the people at the top who'd like to just be able to move up the ladder into a bigger house, through to the second steppers who'd like to be able to have a room that their kid could be in, through to the first time buyers who'd really like to be able to afford a home, through to the people who are sleeping on the streets because they don't have even if enough money to afford the rent on a very, very cheap place. And it's a very important debate in the UK. It's a very important debate internationally. And the more evidence that you have, the more and better factual evidence that you have compared to just spurious talk of Boris bounces from estate agents, the better informed you are and the better the policy making you can do.
Precisely. I like the fact that what you're encompassing there is not just house prices, but the impact of things like transport, et cetera, et cetera, on that. And I think we need to look a bit more holistically. Don't get me wrong, I don't mind house prices, Simon. You know this. The thing I don't like, in fact, is we have about 800 every 5 minutes, which just are totally meaningless when you've got such disparity across the country. What is the point? But don't answer that one, because I've asked that question about a million times.
One final thing, the fantastic returns from investing in property.
Yeah.
A lot of that depends on borrowed money, because the thing in here, house prices have tended to rise over time. So it's not hard to understand why people say they'll always go up and property is better than pension. But £100,000 worth of UK property 25 years ago would be worth an average of £416,000 today. That excludes all the costs of ownership, maintenance, repairs, insurance, taxes. Varies, obviously, by where in the country you are. In London, it would be worth £648,000. In Yorkshire, £356,000. But if you'd invested that £100,000 in the global stock market, so you've spread it all around the world, it would be worth £787,000. So 22% more than even in the best performing regional property market, London, which has been boomtown over that period.
All right, Simon, I'm going to let you take a wee break. Thank you very much for that. No, you're not. That sounds like you're going to leave the studio. You're not. You're not going anywhere, Simon. But I'm just going to turn to you, Lee, if that's all right, because we're going to talk about the banks. Now, they've not exactly been in our good books on this pod of late, let's be honest. And I'm sorry, but that's going to continue now, because today we are on page Lloyds Bank under the subheading Loyalty Doesn't Pay. We've been on this page before. We have the case of one incredibly loyal customer, 40 years, who got £12,000 from a sold PPI payout after he'd been stung for the worthless insurance over that time since he was 18 years old. 18 years old.
That is
40 years.
That is some loyalty.
Has it been going back that long?
What, Lloyds?
No, the PPI stuff.
Oh, the PPI.
Feels like it, don't get me wrong. That and Brexit.
Yeah, Lloyds is a new challenger bank.
Yeah, exactly. Georgie, we need a word about how much you know about this stuff. All right, tell us more. What's going on?
The banks have been at it for decades, Georgie. They've been at it for decades. Richard Harvey. I love this case. This is a great story from our savings and banking reporter, George Nixon. He decided to do a bit of almost like a spurious punt on deadline day. So the PPI claims, they were running like a train. People were just jumping on. We've had claims management firms, people putting in, you know, not sure, have I been missold? Thinking about if you haven't been loyal to the same bank and you've gone with different providers for different things, you know, it got a bit confusing as to what paperwork you needed, how to do it, etc., etc. But a lot of people did, but they finally turned around, set a deadline. Mm-hmm. This is the last date that you can now claim back PPI, 29th of August. Now, Richard, deadline day, a bit Harry Redknapp-esque, he's gone in there and he's put in a claim.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was at 11 p.m. European time or if he's gone UK time on this.
Yeah.
But he said he's gone through the Lloyd's portal. It's taken him 15 minutes. He's been with them for 40 years. He's had all sorts of loans. He's had car loans through them. He's had eight different loans with Lloyd's. He went through the portal, 15 minutes. They've got all of his information. He's been with them forever. Right. So anyway, gets a letter in the new year. £12,000 coming back, roughly. He was missold PPI on two of those loans. And then on a third loan, it was higher than it should have been because of the previous PPI premiums that he'd been paying. So he was due. That's not a bad little New Year bounce, is it?
It's not bad at all. And you think, oh, that's great. And then you think, hang on, there's a reason he's got that money. It's because they've been messing him around for 40 years.
Yeah, and also, we are talking here that the deadline's now been and gone, but it's estimated that actually there was still half of the money that should have been due back and paid out to people that wasn't claimed. You know, it was like 120, 30 billion odd that, you know, was out there. About half of that was claimed. In fact, I've got the figure here, 36.8 billion in total banks had to put aside. 21.9 billion of that was Lloyd's Halifax and the Bank of Scotland. But it does go to show that loyalty pays, Georgie, because we always say on this podcast that it doesn't. But in this case, it does, because he's managed to go back, get it with interest. So it's not that he's
how
just...
How does loyalty... You know I don't like this sort of thing, but how does loyalty pay in this? He was loyal to a company, to a bank.
He trusted that they were acting in his best interest.
And £12,000 says they weren't.
Well, it's not a bad savings account when you get in the interest that you got paid on it, 8%.
Well,
you know.
Yes, Lee,
that is the brilliant thing about this, is that the redress amount was £4,306 for all of the PPI and then this more expensive loan that he had as a result of it. But he got compensatory interest of £7,902.42.
Right, I say.
That's a loyalty bonus.
Good luck earning 8% interest on anything else over the last few years.
Exactly. Well, actually, saying that, we've had...
It's where being ripped off pays, right? That's a bit more than loyalty.
And this is why the headline on this story says the loyalty bonus for being ripped off.
There you go.
Yeah, I forgot the ripped off part, didn't I, George? So we've had other Lloyd's news this week as well. So it's cutting 56 more branches. Mm. It's going to take it to 600. That's with Halifax and Bank of Scotland as well. But it also launched a new savings account. Now, whoa, a savings account that pays more than what it pays, a 1%. First time a big bank has paid a percent for a good 18 months or so. 1%. However, it's fixed for 1 year. It's only open to those that have got £100,000 to put in it. For everyone else, you can get 0.75% over 2 years, which is £15,000 over the financial services compensation limit, which has tickled me this week. So basically, your loyalty doesn't pay unless you're being ripped off and you get 8% and you get that £7,000. Or if you actually want to do things the right way, you could get a percent if you've got £100,000.
But £15,000 won't be protected.
May I just point out?
You may.
That if you have £100,000 in cash that you are looking for an interest rate return on, you should not put it into Lloyd's account. Not but just because of the whole financial services compensation scheme, £85,000 per individually licensed bank issue, which I suppose you could get around by having a joint account, but largely because if you went to another bank, you could get 1.3% to 1.4%. So why would you put the money into Lloyd's account?
So what is the point of this account?
If you really want an interest rate return on that, go put it in someone else's account that will pay you more money. And that's not even taking into account the fact that if you were to get a notice account, your 90-day notice account or something like that, you could bump the rate up. If you fixed it for 1 year, you could bump the rate up. I just want to say one final thing on this, which is a hat tip to one of our readers on Twitter who came up with an idea for the overdrafts.
It's good, isn't it?
Who said, I think the banks should have some form of ratio between the rate they pay on their instant access savings account and their overdraft. I think he was proposing 4.5%, so they'd only be able to charge 4.5% rate on overdrafts and they'd have to pay 1% on their savings accounts.
Not going
to
happen.
That would be a bit different to Lloyd's compared to its 39.9%. Also, I'd like to say that a big thank you to First Direct and Transport for London for reminding me this morning on the tube of how much better my overdraft was.
Okay.
The Get Money Positive account. from First Direct's
advert here. Catchily titled.
Our current account puts you first. That's why we'll give you £100 to join, a £250 interest-free overdraft, and help you to put money aside with our regular saver account. So we've got the £250 0% interest-free overdraft, and then after that, a 15.9% EAR rate on your overdraft. Unfortunately, someone decided to bring in some new rules on overdrafts, and that advert's not valid anymore.
Yeah, I've spotted those posters the last couple of weeks, actually, and thought that's quite sneaky that it's not got the new overdraft rate on there. And the other thing that gets me as well...
I thought about, I'm going to take a Sharpie on the tube next time and just cross it out.
Well, it also looks like they've taken a highlighter pen to some of that advert and gone in a Monzo hot coral pink, which I didn't know if it was on purpose or not, to make it almost look a bit trendier. Hey, look, we can do hot coral pink font as well.
Keep us updated next week whether those ads are still around. One final thing before we do this. I'm sure no hat tips are going to go to Neil Woodford, but it has been a couple of weeks, a few weeks since we've had an update. We do have an update. So investors in the collapsed equity income fund were told this week what cash had been salvaged from some of the underlying assets. Payouts have already started. So just briefly, Simon, just keep us up to date. What's gone on here?
People are going to start getting some of their Woodford money back.
Right.
The liquid stocks, i.e. the ones that it is possible to sell, the listed companies, the larger companies, have been flogged off. And the money is going to be returned to investors. If they invest directly, they might get a check, or they might get it paid into their, might get contacted to get it paid into their bank account. If they hold it with an investment platform, it will probably just get paid back into their investment platform account. Unfortunately, people are looking at a haircut, which obviously they realised they were going to get, and they could be looking at getting only a sort of half of their investment back. And then a nice little bit of news came out just on hot on the heels of that, that an extra £10 million worth of costs have been incurred in selling off these shares, etc. So people absolutely delighted with Neil Woodford prior to this, and probably likely to be even more delighted. They're going to get back between 46.3633p and 58.9936p per share, depending on what version or share class of the fund they held. Each share was worth £1 when those different share classes were launched. So that just sort of goes to show.
And how much did Neil Woodford earn from this and fees and all that?
Not sure of the running total of what Neil Woodford personally has earned from this, but it's in the tens of millions of pounds.
Yeah.
And him and his business partner, Craig Newman, in the final year of operation, took out £14 million, I believe, from the company that was paid to themselves or their separate company in dividends. So at least they've made out like bandits.
Yeah, precisely, they'll be happy. All right, well, you can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you would like them to look into, Simon?
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney. And you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to join in the debate in the comments. And finally, I would like to wish all of you, whether you voted to remain or leave or didn't really know which one to go for and just quickly stuck an X in the box, happy Brexit.
Happy Brexit. So I'll be in Spain. With any luck, I'll be allowed back into the country. So if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.
This Is Money's podcast is brought to you in partnership with the Financial Services Compensation Scheme. Check your financial products at FSCS Protected at fscs.org.uk/thisismoney.